We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Well, over time, it seems, more and more of our time is spent using media. We use it at work. We use it when we play. We use it when we communicate with family and friends. It gets into all areas of our lives. But it's also true that as media has become more pervasive, it also, in a way, becomes more invisible, making it easier to take it for granted. And certainly it is true that it's easy to forget the kind of changes that we've seen have happened over a relatively short period of time. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the changing role of media in our lives and society, and our guest for the program is Mark Doise. He is professor of communications at Indiana University, and this is something that he's done a lot of thinking about and writing about and working on and continues to do so. And part of the reason that we're talking is to let people know here who are in and around Champaign-Urbana that he will be here next week on the 9th. A week from today, to give a talk. He's been invited by the graduate students of the Infrastructure Intersections Between Social and Technological Systems program to give a talk on something that he's working on, something called the Media Life Project. And the essence here, and something we'll talk about, is the argument that, in fact, it's not so much a case anymore that we are living with media, but, in fact, we are living in media, and we'll talk a little bit more about what that means. Questions, of course, are welcome here on the program. We invite people into the conversation with their questions and comments. The only thing we ask is that people try to be brief because we want to keep moving and get as many callers in as possible. But callers are welcome. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455, we do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, certainly calls and questions are welcome. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, Professor Doise, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
I was just thinking, I guess, thinking here, you know, this is not particularly profound, but I suppose I was thinking about the fact now that so much of our time is engaged in using media, and that because of the internet and because there are so many pocket-sized devices that do things like play music and video and make phone calls and send texts and surf the web, that seems so much of a part of our life now, it is easy to forget that this kind of thing, it's really only about, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we're really only about a decade into this kind of level of media use that we have now.
Absolutely correct. And it is startling to see that as we move at this blistering speed in this sort of complete media-saturated lifestyle, that when colleagues do research on how people use their media, for example, asking people how many hours do you watch TV, or how many texts do people send in any given day, that what they find increasingly in this, for example, 10-year span that you talk about, is that increasingly people forget that they've used media. So the more we become immersed in media, the more we're likely to forget that we're doing that in the first place. And that's sort of the starting point for the kind of work that we've done on this Media Life Project.
Yeah. And that's something I think you make an interesting point, that providers of media, they actually like the idea that they're invisible. I'm not sure that they want us thinking very much or very deeply about how powerful they are.
Well, yes and no. Of course, I mean, the more we use media, the more that will benefit, as you say, the providers, both the telecommunications companies, the Comcasts and AT&Ts of this world, or the big media industries, or the professionals who create content, for sure. On the other hand, I mean, when we use media so how should I put it, without really consciously or deliberately choosing to do so. Like, it's become just a part of the way we live, as especially young people say in research, right? It's just a way of life. I mean, don't bother me with how many hours I watch TV. It's what I do. When we don't choose media deliberately anymore, the control over our media use disappears. For example, I mean, watching television is in the industry is called watching television programming. Now, the word programming is used to talk about us. We are being programmed to watch a television show at, for example, 8 p.m. every Monday evening. The moment we stop doing that nicely and meekly at 8 p.m. and we just watch it in bits and pieces on YouTube, on our DVRs 10 days later, or on our mobile phones when somebody forwards us a link, the industry loses control over us. And so, yes, on the one hand, they love it that we spend every waking moment with media. On the other hand, they hate it because they're losing control. So that's an interesting paradox right there.
Yeah. I want to have you talk a little bit more about this distinction between living with media and living in media. What exactly do you mean?
Well, I mean, my colleagues and I, people who study media and mass communication, traditionally I've always studied it using the notion that media are things outside of our lives, the things that come at us. Including the devices, the TV set or the cell phone is something that is outside of us, right? It doesn't grow on us or something like that. And content, that means that we study media effects. For example, do violent video games produce violent kids? Or we even study, and especially in recent years, the people who make media. We interview them, we ask them, you know, how they are so darn successful in making us want more every time we see a television show. And I've realized that the problem with that viewpoint is that that media really isn't outside of us anymore. I mean, I'm always struck that if you ask kids, I mean, especially our undergraduate students or young people in general about their media, they generally have this sense of, well, I mean, not really being sure what you're actually asking about, right? It's just something they do. I mean, you can't really walk from A to B anywhere anymore without your headphones on, or drive in your car from A to B without some kind of device telling you where to turn left. So it's not so much that media are outside of us, and that's the way we've always made sense of media. And I'm suggesting that if we continue doing that, we're actually missing the point. We're not really explaining or helping people to understand what media actually do to them.
And this is, I think this is an important point, and certainly something that is important to scholars of media and society. And but I think in some way it ought to be something that means something to all of us, because it has something to say, or at least it gives us, I think, something very important to think about, and that is in what ways I suppose what it gets down to is a question of control, really, and whether the media is shaping us or whether we are using the tool of the media to shape ourselves.
Absolutely. And listen, I mean, is the media the director or the reflector of our lives? Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say that if you look at media the old way, like media come to us and then we have to respond, right? We switch off the TV, or we understand when there's an ad directed at us instead of a public service message or something like that. That in the old way of thinking, if you ask the question, is the media the director or the reflector of what happens to us, you get stuck in these arguments that, okay, well, yes, there is more and more violence in video games and movies. On the other hand, society is becoming statistically less violent all the time. But then there are people that play a lot of these games and go in high school and kill people. And, I mean, this is an endless debate. It's an important debate, but it doesn't really resolve anything. And there's obviously something more to this. I mean, what does the experience of playing video games your entire life, right? Young kids grow up today with an Xbox, like, pre-installed in their baby room, I would almost say. What does the experience of playing a video game tell you about your role in the world? And so what I, for example, this may sound very abstract, but to make it very concrete, one thing that is unique about playing a video game, almost regardless whatever game you play, is that when you play it, your experience of that game is different from when somebody else plays it. This is very different from back in the days when you and I were watching TV. If we were watching the same program, regardless of where we would be in the world, we would have basically have the same experience. The only thing we can do to it is, like, you know, switch the TV off. But other than that, we had no power, no agency. We couldn't really change the reality of that program at all. And now you have kids that grow up in a world where they start off with not watching TV shows, but building online social networks like Facebook or Club Penguin or something like that, and playing video games, which give them a unique experience that is exclusive to them. They are in control of the way they experience reality. And I think that's a large part of the reason why adults or parents have so much trouble communicating with their children and vice versa about what the role of media in their lives is, stems from that distinction.
Let me introduce again our guest with this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Mark Deutze. He is a professor of communication at Indiana University in Bloomington. And he is somebody who's very interested in, among other things, the way that media shapes our lives to the point where it's not just something we use, but it's something that we're in. A life lived in media, a media life, that's the kind of phrase that he and others have used to try to talk about this and to think about this. He'll be here on this campus a week from today to talk about this very thing, and was good enough to come on the show here and to give us some of his time and talk a little bit about it this morning to explore some of these ideas. And questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, when you use the phrase media as reflector, I guess I go back to something that a conversation that I had a long, long time ago. I guess it must have made an impression on me with Jim Carrey, who was the dean of our college here for a long time and right. is well known for his writings about media and society. And the point that always stuck with me from this conversation was it had to do with this question. Well, what is it that people are looking for in media? What do they want from media? And this would have been at a time when there was, this was before the internet and before this level of connectivity that we have now and all of the things that we have. And it gets at this idea that do people want their, in a sense, do they want their horizons to be broadened? Or what they're looking for from media essentially to reflect themselves? But they want to look into the media mirror, and they don't want to see the big world. It's not like a window. No, they want to see themselves. And that's something that really stuck with me because I think that it's very true. So that would lead one to ask this question. Are we now getting to the point where, because of the technologies we're talking about and the pervasiveness of media, that it's the idea that people are in these bubbles? Is it even more than it ever has been in the past? And is that something we should be worried about?
That's a wonderful way of thinking about it. I mean, there's this absolutely beautiful novel that was written in the 1920s by Italian writer Luigi Pirandello, who later on went on to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. And in this book, he describes the situation of a man who he has it pretty good, right? I mean, he has a lovely wife, a good job. I mean, he's turning 50, and he looks at himself in the mirror one morning, and he thinks, you know, I'm still look pretty good. I mean, not too bad at all. And then his wife walks into the room and sees him staring at himself in the mirror, and he sort of smiles at her and like, yeah, you know, I'm turning 50, I'm still doing quite well. And she says, Yeah, I mean, you're great. It's just a shame that your nose is a little bit crooked to the left. And he, what? No, my nose is perfect. And so he checks himself in the mirror and checks again, and darn it, his nose is crooked to the left. He never saw that before. And this is the start in this novel of like a project that he does, that he starts talking to everybody in his life and asks them how they see him. And what happens is that he notices that everybody has a different view of him. And they all contain details that he never saw himself. People say he walks a bit funny when he runs, or people say he always has this weird slur when he talks in meetings. Or, I mean, little things, tiny little things that completely disturb or disrupt the image he has of himself. And he spends his life, the rest of his life, trying to figure out who he really is. For example, he walks on the street and he sees a mirror, and then he tries to catch himself in the mirror so he can see himself as others see him. And, you know, it doesn't work, and he goes insane. And only in the end of the book, he becomes sane again by realizing that to find out how you are, how you see yourself, is impossible. You just have to let it go and live your life and be happy. Now, you were asking, why do people immerse themselves so much in media? Why we go crazy in the media? Why we share every detail of our private lives in the media? If you look at Facebook profiles, MySpace, those kind of things, nothing seems to be secret anymore. Well, there's a good argument to be made that, and I think Professor Carey had a wonderful point there, is that, yes, we do want to see ourselves. And if you study what people primarily do with media, is that the number one thing people do with media is tell stories about themselves. Mm. Whether it's a text that they send to somebody, whether it's information they upload to their Facebook profile, even in a little thing like programming your DVR, that is a story you tell about yourself. If that's the primary motive, then there's actually a lot to be learned from what kind of stories people tell about themselves.
And I think this is a really interesting point, because it says that there's something a little bit more subtle here than perhaps we have recognized. People have been very concerned about the willingness, particularly of younger people, to distribute personal information about them. And
right.
It's very easy to do that now. And there are real concerns that people may be giving away information about themselves that later they might wish that they could take back, but that nothing ever goes away now. Mm-hmm. But you're making a different sort of point, and in fact, that may still be true. I mean, that's something that's perhaps worth talking about and thinking about. But
sure.
That what you're also saying is that the version of the self that people are putting out there is still something that they're making and deciding what goes in there and what doesn't. So, in fact, that it's not their real self. It may be the self they would like to think that they are, or that they would like other people to see, but it's still a created kind of a thing, and that they are creating it.
Right. No, absolutely. Listen, I mean, privacy is an important issue here, but... Again, I mean, research among younger people suggests that they do understand that they're giving away incredibly private information. And there is some evidence to suggest that they are weighing their options and they are editing or redacting their own information to the extent that they are aware that sooner or later it might come back to haunt them. Now, so the problem they have with the kind of privacy and the rules and regulations that you and I talk about is that those are rules and regulations of their parents, of adults, of people imposing rule systems onto them based on a worldview that doesn't meshes with the kind of control that they have about telling stories about themselves. And the interesting thing, too, is that especially among children, the number one benefit they see from engaging with media this intensely is, in fact, the sharing of personal information. That is like the quality, the additional quality that they can't get from, you know, watching TV and then next day in the schoolyard talking about it. So there's a social aspect to all of this. That yes, on the one hand, people use media primarily to tell stories about themselves. Those stories are, I think you correctly state, not exactly true, but they're also not exactly false either. They perhaps are idealized versions of themselves or versions that they would like other people to know about. And we can talk about that for sure, what that means. But the reason why they're doing that is to connect with other people. So there is an incredibly individualistic element to this. Like, I just want to see myself live. And that's why I'm dumping like almost all my personality into the media that I use. And there's a social element to it that I primarily do this to connect with others, because, as we all know, the only way to make sense of who you are is by getting the version of yourself validated by others, right? Others, people help you define what is real about yourself. And that's how especially young people use media.
Well, I just want to come back to this point that about the fact that it seems that, and particularly I think this applies to younger people, that now the way that we live our lives, it seems that the line between the private and the public has become very blurred.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Is that a problem?
Well, yes, and here's two pink pills that you can take to remedy it, right?
Oh, good. I was hoping that you'd have something for me for that. Yeah, I'm sure though, there may be some bad side effects, though. We've got to watch those.
Yeah, did I tell you that my project is sponsored by a pharmaceutical company?
Oh, well, I'm glad in the interest now of full disclosure you've laid that out.
No, right. I mean, the boundary between private and public is blurred. Absolutely, right? There is no distinction. Just as the boundary between, time spent working and time spent living or playing is blurred. It's the same thing. That's a really interesting thing. I mean, you can say that's a problem, or you can say, well, those categories belong to a different time. Those categories belong to a time where the different elements of our life spent at home, our life spent at work, our life spent playing, neatly organized and packaged and pre-planned and routinized and all those wonderful things that we often use to refer to the time where we still had nuclear families and people marrying the girl next door and taking over their father's business. Well, that time is gone, right? It doesn't exist. Less than 25% of American households are nuclear families. So the vast majority of people in this country or in any especially Western democratic country live their lives in a much more fluid way. And media accelerate and amplify that process. Now, that's not necessarily a problem. I think the only problem there is if we keep on talking about this kind of life as a kind of life that we need to escape from, right? We have to escape from this all-powerful, omnipresent media, or we have to escape from blurring the distinction between public and private, because I think that's unrealistic and not particularly helpful. The problem then becomes, how can we be, and that's the kind of fundamental question I ask in the kind of work that I and my graduate students are doing, how can we be free and completely mediated at the same time?
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Mark Deutz. He's a professor in the Department of Telecommunications at Indiana University in Bloomington. He's also professor in journalism and new media at Leiden University in the Netherlands. And he is interested in a number of things, in people who work in media, and also the way that we live with media and live in media. A media life is the kind of phrase that's been used to describe this. He's going to be here visiting on the campus of the University of Illinois a week from today to talk about this very thing. He'll be here invited by graduate students of the Infrastructure Intersections Between Social and Technological Systems program, here to talk about the Media Life Project, something that he and others are working on, have been doing that for some time. If you'd like to learn more about him, you can go and look at his website on the IU campus. And the questions here are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. This thing that you were just talking about, this blurring of the line between private and public and the way that we live our lives, partly this has something to do with technology, or at least we'd have to say, well, the technology makes it possible. I think also, though, you would say that it's not just technology, and this is not just the result of technology, not just the result of the fact that we have these devices that can make it possible. Is there something else going on there? I suppose, does the willingness to do it have to be there when the tools come along to do it?
Well, technology doesn't really do anything to us, right? Technology... I find that the best, or let me put it this way, the most inspiring way to think about technology, the devices, the hardware and the software that govern the things that we do at work or at home or when we're playing, that technology amplifies what's already there. It makes it seem bigger. In a very basic way, you can argue that what people do on MySpace and Facebook, on online social networks. I mean, posting stories about themselves and displaying the links they have with their friends, all 300,000 of them, is in a way just an amplification of something that human beings did the very moment when they stopped running away from mammoths and saber tigers and moved into caves. They started drawing pictures of themselves on walls. It was the absolute first thing that human beings did when they stopped running around and started moving in, lived in groups and hid in caves, telling stories about themselves. And it's what people do. And if given the chance, people use media to tell stories of themselves. I mean, you could almost argue that this 20th century phenomenon of mass media, big networks and studios that determine what we see and hear, and newspapers like the New York Times with taglines stating all the news that's fit to print, and who decides what's fit to print is, you know, 300 white guys in a newsroom in lower Manhattan. That era was an anomaly. It was kind of weird. This was like a temporary time where a handful of people had to control over what kind of stories we were telling about ourselves and our society. But what people really do all the time is tell stories. And so if you give them the kind of tools that we have today, obviously that's what they do, and not just a handful or a small elite that is educated. No. Everybody. And that's overwhelming, and it sort of seems like a new thing. But in a way, it's just connecting to something very fundamental about our human nature, is that we tell stories to figure out who we are and where we belong to.
I guess that raises in my mind the issue that, though, it seems to be an important difference between the way mass media has operated not all that long ago and where we are now, and that is that at one point it really was the case that mass media really were mass media, and that for good or ill, and probably some of both, it brought people together. And yet now what's happening is that the kinds of tools that we're talking about, the kind of media that we're talking about, what it does is it brings people together, but it seems to bring them together in sometimes fairly small, tightly knit communities of interest, and that they're very inward looking. And I'm sure there would be people who would be prepared to argue that there's some reason to be concerned about that, and particularly how that affects our politics.
Well, there's two things I would love to connect to what you just said. I mean, so if in the old system, which still to some extent exists today, let's not just throw it away immediately. Uh-huh. But in the old system, the primary role of mass media was to bring us together around specific programs and specific people. I mean, people often think back of the wonderful days of Walter Cronkite or, you know, the campfire chats. Wonderful time where most people would watch the same kind of shows, have access to the same kind of news and information, and had a shared sense of reference when they would talk about, for example, politics. So what people now do today in media is still connect, but almost without the help, if you will, of mass media or party politics. And those connections are much less predictable as they used to be. They're much, and so I want to take issue a little bit with what you just said. I don't think those communities that we find online are tightly knit. In fact, they're loosely knit. I mean, they don't remain stable over time. What was big 3 years ago has all but disappeared today. 5 years ago, we didn't have Facebook or YouTube, and now it dominates everything. 5 years from now, they'll be gone. So the connections are much more fragile and flexible and unstable, making them very unpredictable. Now, in terms of politics, like, how do we make sense of our role in democracy as citizens? Well, it's kind of the same story. I mean, we used to be citizens only insofar that the political parties of our country would call on us every 4 years to get up and walk to a voting booth and sign on the dotted line. And we would elect officials that were selected for us by generally elitist, rich, white, middle-class groups, the Republicans and the Democrats, for example, in this country. Today, citizenship to people means something very differently. It's something that's very private, very personal, based on people's personal interests, wants, and needs. And they connect with other people to make sense of that role as a citizen without necessarily any help from the news industry or from the political party industry. So they bypass those intermediaries and figure things out on their own. And yes, part of that means that they cluster in groups and, you know, kick and scream against anything that's happening in the country, and they're convincing each other that 9/11 was a CIA plot and that President Obama isn't really American. But part of it is also a bridge is being built between groups and communities of people, both inside the country and around the world. So there is a lot going on, and that shoots in all directions. And all that it has in common with each other is that it's very unpredictable and fragile, and it consists of people doing things exclusively based on their own personal wants and needs, while at the same time connecting with other people. I find there's a lot of hope there. At least that's my personal bias, I guess.
Let me ask you a little bit different question. Now it seems that probably, I hesitate to say everyone, but almost everyone has a phone and they carry it with them. So we are at a point now where unless people choose to be, people are never not reachable. That kind of instant communication is possible almost all the time. We have access to an enormous variety of information in different forms. And so I wonder, are we going to get to a point where some people are going to say, enough, I've had it, and are really going to start turning off and paring back, or whether that's just going to become more accepted and people are just going to say, well, they're not even going to think about it. It's just going to be, that is just the way that it is.
I think the latter, that people aren't just not going to think about it. I'll give you an example. Like when we first started worrying about this, about all powerful and omnipresent media and technology in our lives, this was in the 1980s, just before the World Wide Web hit us in the early 1990s. And for example, look at the kind of movies that came out around that time about this kind of topic. And I especially think of the Terminator movies with the Governator, right? I mean, it's movies that talk about machines and technology taking over our lives. And the moment they do that, they realize, we actually don't need you anymore. And then they try to destroy us. And it was kind of this vision of what will happen when we give away ourselves completely to media technology. Because, of course, Skynet in the Terminator movies was a computer, the kind of computer that we now have in our cell phone. So that was sort of the 1980s. Today, that worry has almost completely disappeared. Nobody really is talking about the machines taking over our lives. It kind of already happened. And it hasn't turned us into robots or made us simply, like in The Matrix, a bunch of batteries, right? I mean, we still live our lives. We still connect. I mean, one out of five marriages in the United States today started as an online relationship. I mean, you can't call that kind of human and machine interaction dangerous or unreal. I mean, I'm certain those marriages and those married people are extremely happy. We're living in a different kind of world, but that kind of concern, although legitimate, I don't think really exists anymore. I'll give you another example when we talk about the movies, or a wonderful sort of metaphors for the way we think about this. I mean, in the mid-1990s, there was this wonderful movie called The Truman Show. Mm-hmm. You may remember it. Jim Carrey played the lead role of a man who slowly but surely finds out that his entire life is a reality television show. And that everybody is in on it except him. He is the only, like the name of his character suggests, true man, in that he is the only one who doesn't know that media are everywhere and nothing is real. And in the end of that movie, and it's a kind of a spoiler alert for your listeners, he decides to escape, which is kind of the kind of question you just ask. Like, will people at some point say, enough is enough, I want to get out, I want to disconnect? And like Truman, they'll escape the studio. Well, I don't think escape is possible. And I would almost argue that the real way to find power in this situation, in this life, is not to find out ways that you can disconnect from your devices. Because even if you do, which is largely impossible, have you ever tried to actually switch off a cell phone or a TV? You can't. I mean, TV, you have to unplug the plug, which is buried behind this massive monstrous thing that we have in our living rooms, which nobody ever does. They only go on standby, right? They keep on. They stay on, like you said earlier. They are always on. It's not so much about disconnecting or trying to disconnect. That's not where real power is. Power is staying online, staying connected, but figuring things out for yourself, telling your own story, telling stories that are truly important and that helps change your and maybe perhaps even the lives of others in a way that is better than it is now. So I don't think that the future is about trying to disconnect again, but it's trying to be, I guess, better connected. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I do find myself thinking about, though, examples of stories like The Truman Show or like The Matrix, and and wonder to what extent whether people are asking this question, and I guess people have been asking that question for a long, long time, as they think about their lives, asking themselves the question, is this real?
Right. Is there,
you know, and who's writing this story? Am I writing this story? Is somebody else writing this story? Well, have people stopped asking those questions, do you think?
Well, no, I think people are increasingly asking those questions, often unconsciously. I mean, this notion of is this real? Just a small, tiny example. The idea for this project came out of the last 8 or 9 years of teaching at Indiana University and before that at the University of Amsterdam where I worked. I love teaching these big undergraduate sort of introduction to media and society courses. So I have 400 to 600 students every semester. It's a wonderful experience, at least for me. And one thing I do is do a little survey among the students, just to figure out how they use media and what goes on in their lives with media. And the final question of those surveys is always, how sure are you that this is real? You know, this campus, this town that you live in, the state of Indiana, for example, the country, United States. How convinced are you on a scale from 1 to 5 that this is real? And I can tell you, half of students don't think it's real. And there's about 40-45% who thinks are pretty sure that it's real, and a handful just has no idea. And I mean, to me, that's fascinating, that 18, 19-year-old kids walk around the world not quite sure that all of this is real. Now, there's actually a group of psychiatrists, both in the UK and in Canada and in the United States, that have begun to sort of map out a diagnosis of this condition, the condition that we not quite sure whether the reality is still real, that we, like you suggest, feel that we don't have control over the story of our lives anymore, and that media have something to do with this. And they actually call it, like the movie we just discussed, the Truman Show delusion. Mm-hmm. And of course they're worried, and how do we treat patients who come into therapy, and media is everywhere, everything I do is recorded, I'm being watched, and okay, fair enough. But in a way, and that's what the psychiatrists argue, we all have this kind of neurosis in a mild form, that we're not entirely sure that everything is real, that is everybody really who they say they are, or are they acting? And maybe we are all acting to some extent, and what media do to us is make us aware of it. And I'm a professor, so I have to argue being aware of something means you have power over it. You can actually do something with it. That's, to me, the role of education, becoming aware of things so that you can do something with them rather than being controlled by them.
Mm. So I guess you would make the argument that if you think that you're an actor in a play, well, go ahead. You might as well do that, but write the part.
Yeah.
Write your own part.
Well, there's this recent movie that just came out, The Brothers Bloom. There's this wonderful line that one of the characters mentions in the movie because it's two brothers that spend their entire life conning other people by playing all kinds of roles. And at the end of the movie, one of the brothers just wants to get out. He says, I'm tired of this. I don't want a written life. Right, I want a life of my own. I don't want a life that's scripted in all these roles that I constantly have to play. And then his brother tells, there is no such thing as an unwritten life. There's only such a thing as a badly written one. And I think that's very appropriate at what we're talking about. I mean, I think a media life has potentially the power to give you control over the script. I'm not so naive that I think, you know, you can write yourself into the role of a king. But at the very least, you can write yourself in the role of strengthening the relationships and the bonds you have with the people that you truly care about. And you know, as research at Harvard suggests about happiness, is that what truly defines happiness for people that they've followed for generations is not necessarily, you know, a good job or your health. It's having a strong circle of friends. And those are the kind of parts that we can write in a media life.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Mark Deutze. He is associate professor in the Department of Telecommunications at Indiana University, Bloomington. Questions welcome. We have several. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll start with someone in Savoy. Line one. Hello.
Well, good morning. I was interested in hearing your guest speak more about life in the Netherlands. I'd particularly like to know what the major concerns are over there. And regarding the media, how do they handle television? Are there stations in every larger town, or is there just one or two? And do you get reception from stations from nearby countries? Is there the equivalent of a European CNN? What's life like over there in the Netherlands?
Well, I'm sure we have time. At least you can give a couple of minutes to that if you like. Go ahead.
I really appreciate the question. Life in the Netherlands is quite wonderful, although I moved to the United States, so I think it's better here. But that's my personal bias. Media in the Netherlands, I mean, and this is, I guess, really important to realize, and it speaks to the kind of story that we've been talking about today, is that Dutch media aren't necessarily Dutch media, just as American media aren't American. Quick example, about 60%, 60 to 70% of every television show and movie that you see in an American theater or an American network or cable station doesn't come from the United States. It may feature American actors, but it was produced elsewhere, in Canada, in Mexico, in Ireland, in Malaysia, Australia, whatever. And we're beginning to realize this, that when we access the world through media, that is truly a world. It's not the United States anymore. And the same is in I guess America, because it's so large and the media system is so powerful, we're only beginning to realize this now. Whereas in the Netherlands, which is a tiny, tiny little country, it's much smaller than even Indiana or Illinois, has always been the case, right? The vast majority of TV channels are from all over the world. We indeed have American CNN and a European CNN. CNN has separate stations in the UK and Germany. And we get the Daily Show with Jon Stewart and Bill O'Reilly on Fox, and about 70 to 80% of all programming on Dutch television is American or British or German or Australian. Of course, channels from all over Europe. So the experience of people with media in a small country like the Netherlands has always been very much an experience of being in the world. The world being exposed to us through media, and television plays a huge role in that, of course.
All right. Well, I hope that helps with the caller's question. We only have about 5 minutes left, and I have three other callers, so we'll go next to Effingham, line number four, our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes. I'll be short if I can. The basic cornerstone of today's present social organization is based on patriarchy or patriotism. If you could address that and the dislodging of maternalism through their violent methods. And I haven't saw it yet, but maybe you know about the movie Capitalism, A Love Story. Thank you.
Well, I don't know. Is there something that you can do with that?
Well, yes, we were talking about earlier that like we were concerned about the boundaries are being erased between private and what is private and what is public. Mm-hmm. And we talked about that those concerns actually belong to an older time, in the mid-20th century time where mass media dominated everything and life was organized in neat little categories. Now, that time also belonged to what the caller talked about as patriarchy, right? That the husband is the primary breadwinner, and that provided some sense of continuity and stability in people's lives at that time, obviously based on the repression of women and ethnic minorities and so on, but still. And what you see happening today is, as we know now, the majority of breadwinners in the United States are women, not men. And so there is that stable system of patriarchy and even capitalism, well, consider the crash that we experience in a recession, is, well, at the very least, it's a very rocky road we're on. There is this sort of fluidity, a sense of that everything is in flux and uncertain in all domains of life. And the media life perspective connects to that in the sense that the way people live their lives in media has also that sort of uncertain, flexible, very loosely knit quality. So there's a mirroring effect there.
All right. Next to Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Oh, hi. I'll make this quick. I read fiction, and I wrote a story about a year ago about this internet, this whole technology scenario we live in, where people surrendered their whole lives to this, like you would say, the net or the cloud web or whatever, and how they were unafraid of their privacy. They didn't. Privacy just ceased to exist, and the whole structure of the short story was it was an acknowledgement that just to go on beyond your life, like, you know, if you go into a graveyard, you see, you know, tombstones. That's sort of the remnant of that person's life. If you go back to early Greek and Romans, they would have elaborate carved, you know, scenes of these people's, you know, their relationships to the gods and stuff like that. And sort of what people did is sort of used the internet, or what we call now the internet. They used it as a mnemonic device as a remembrance of themselves. So they basically just said, I don't care, you know, everything about me is known. I just wondered what you thought of that.
That's a great, I mean, yeah. In a way, that story isn't science.
I'll send you a copy of it if you want.
Yeah. Well, in a way, it's not a science fiction story anymore. This is very much the way we live now, right?
Yeah. Young kids will you know, say anything on the web. I mean,
right.
We as adults, I'm 60 years old, and I'm very private, so I don't want people, you know, knowing every little thing about me. Excuse me.
No, that's a fantastic comment. And the only thing I would take issue with is that we surrender ourselves to media, and I think that's, I mean, there is nothing to surrender to. The media are us, right? Yeah. I mean, like Toys R Us, media are us.
Yeah.
And I think it's an interesting premise that if you die in the physical world, mm-hmm. but your avatar in a game like World of Warcraft goes on, have you really died?
Yeah.
And there is still this log of hundreds of thousands of websites, of Facebook profiles that where you left your mark, where you left information.
Yeah,
is that still death in the same way? I mean, it's one of the things I'm going to talk about next week, about the experience of love, sex,
here,
and
right?
death. So.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because it really is about something that's almost like becoming – it's sort of becoming something on its own. You know what I mean? It's like not guided. There's no – like rules, like when you go to university, I have a PhD and stuff. When you go to college, you teach people, you have a script, or what do you call it, a syllabus. And, I mean, it's people just doing this almost on their own. I mean, this whole thing is on its own. It's like
becoming
something completely independent of what, with no guidance. And I the whole story talks about that. When you're here, I'll get a chance to try to see you. I'll come up with you.
I would appreciate that.
Yeah.
I would really appreciate that.
Well,
thanks.
I thank you. Let's get one more caller here. This is also someone in Urbana, line three. Hello.
Hi. I'll try to be very brief. Listening to you, it just made me think about the fact that we live a lot of our lives in our imagination anyway. I mean, that's what artists do. You have no idea if what your perception of what's going on in the world is the same as anyone else. And it seems that now we just have all these different forms of media as lenses to that and to theoretically connect somebody's imagination to somebody else's. But that's what art has always been, it's particularly performance art. You know, there's that, I was a dancer. Are you living, you know, what about that is not real? So I think it's just a different way of experiencing it. And for those of us who I'm sort of in the mid-generation between, you know, a lot of this media came about as I was coming of age, and it's just a different way of learning the world, you know, and kids now are growing up learning it that way, so they do have a different sense of privacy or how you construct self. It's just a different way of doing things that people have always done.
That's a wonderful comment, and it speaks to something very fundamental. I mean, philosophers argue that the real fundamental anxiety of being a human being is knowing that nobody can know you, right? Nobody can look inside your head. No matter how many chips they implant, they will never accurately read exactly who you are. That also means you can't really know anybody else. So our entire lives are made up in essentially, as this caller suggested, I think correctly, out of telling as much stories about ourselves and others as possible so that we at least can find some common ground, right? We are social animals. We need to be in order to survive. And what we see now in the media, and it maybe partly explains sort of the frenzy that we've seen of living a life in media, is that we are closer to figuring out each other's heads than ever before, but still not, it will never be complete. But that anxiety plays out, amplified in a tremendous way in our media lives.
Well, we are going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say, at this point, because we have exhausted our time for this hour of Focus 580. But I do want to mention that our guest for this hour of the program, Mark Deutze, is going to be here on the campus next week, a week from today. He's here at the invitation of graduate students of the Infrastructure Intersections Between Social and Technological Systems program. He's going to be here talking about the Media Life Project. This event starts at 12:30 in the afternoon in the Coordinated Science Laboratory. That's room B-02, the auditorium, and I'm assuming that anybody who is in and around the campus who'd be interested in hearing from him would be welcome to show up. And if you'd like to find out more about him and read a paper that's kind of a work in progress talking about the media life, you can go to his website, which you can get at easily through the Indiana University website. Our guest is Associate Professor of Telecommunications at Indiana University Bloomington, and Professor Deutze, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.